Geek Speak for Monday, May 7th. I'm KDNK station manager Gavin Dahl. The geeks are taking a break this month, and we have several interesting programs coming up the next few weeks. The Andy Zinka Youth Empowerment Program will be bringing voices of veterans from the Valley to the airwaves next Monday. And then on Monday, May 21st, I'll host an Ask Me Anything live call-in show. But don't turn that dial today. We're featuring a really interesting interview with Christopher Mitchell, the director of the Community Broadband Network Initiative with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. He's based in Minneapolis, and he's working with communities that are creating their own municipal broadband services. In-kind support for KDNK comes from your membership and from Louie the Computer Guy, providing PC and Mac repair, networking support, tutoring, and web design, secure, informed, and connected. Info at 948-7992. And from Umbrella Roofing, providing roofing contractor services, gutter installation, and architectural sheet metal fabrication for the Roaring Fork and Eagle Valleys. Umbrella Roofing can be reached at umbrella-roofing.com and 704-9130. Last November, voters in 19 cities and counties in Colorado voted to opt out of State Senate Bill 152. That was just the latest bunch of local governments to do so, and that was legislation written by cable and telephone corporations, which restricts local government spending on building a broadband network. Now, communities like Fort Collins and Boulder are taking the next steps in creating a municipal broadband service, much like the city of Longmont did some years ago. Mitchell says that people in these communities need to have reasonable expectations. Boulder is inviting community feedback on next steps in the broadband project. Mitchell says it's key that communities get involved in the entire process, as there's so much at stake, particularly with an uncertain future for net neutrality. Maeve Conran at KGNU in Boulder did this interview and shared it with the Rocky Mountain Community Radio Coalition. Stay tuned to Geek Speak right here on KDNK.
First of all, let's go back to why voters need to be approving all of this. Longmont voters overwhelmingly approved the city's ability to provide broadband several years ago, but it had to go to the ballot several times. We've recently seen just this year several rural communities in Colorado also approving it. Why do voters even need to approve this? Take us back to the history of how industry has set up this system where voters need to even go to the ballot to approve allowing, you know, municipal control of broadband.
Well, the ancient history actually starts with how we built the cable networks and the telephone networks, which is that broadly we gave a monopoly franchise of a territory to a company, and then they were able to build it because they knew they'd get all the customers. But in 1996, we decided through the Telecommunications Act of 1996 that we would have competition and that anyone could offer services. And there was explicit discussion about municipal electric utilities in particular entering into this field. Shortly after that was passed, the telephone companies and the big cable companies went to state legislatures to restrict local governments from getting into this, because those big monopolies saw the cable, they saw that the cities would be competition. And the big cable and telephone companies, they knew that they'd be able to drive out competition from small private companies just by using their monopoly power. But they were threatened by the cities. And so Colorado in 2005, at the urging of CenturyLink's predecessor, passed a law that basically said cities can't do this. Now, Colorado, because of the actions of the cities defending themselves, included something that almost no other state has, that has such a restriction. And so what's unique in Colorado is the ability of cities to opt out of that repressive state law. And that's what we've seen about 120 local governments across Colorado do to date.
Well, Longmont did this several years ago, and it's now really in the final stages of rolling out its municipal broadband. Fort Collins also did it. Boulder has done it. And this year, several rural communities have done it. Now that these communities are now taking the next step and actually rolling out municipal broadband, what are the questions communities should be asking?
Well, I think one of the key things is that people have reasonable expectations. The vote to restore local authority is one that starts a process. It's not in the middle of the process. It's not at the end of the process. So for each community, they have to look at what options are right for them. In the Western Rockies, you see the towns around Montrose have opted out of the law, but then they decided to go with an electric co-op expanding service. And that's a very good decision for them. It's going to be quite successful, I have no doubt. Other places, they're building it themselves. Cortez in the southwest part of the state, they've long been building a municipal network, not unlike what Longmont has done, but there's some differences. But it's city-owned there. So the key thing is, I think, to recognize that there's no easy solution after you've passed a referendum like that. You need to look at what your unique assets are, what the challenges are, what technology might be right to embrace right away, and how to structure that with maybe a co-op or a municipal approach. But the key thing is you just can't do nothing. If you do nothing, you're going to be stuck with the same services that all the other communities that have done nothing will have, which will be slow DSL and maybe a little bit of fiber, but probably a cable company for the cities that are a little bit larger.
Does it look different in rural versus urban communities? Because we're seeing this happen now. We're seeing a lot of rural communities dealing with this, but also urban communities like Fort Collins and Boulder.
Yes, there's a huge difference between urban and rural. You know, urban areas, you're at least going to have like a Comcast provider in Colorado. Comcast and Charter they're not terrible. They're frustrating to deal with. They have high prices. But it's a heck of a lot better than in a rural area where you might only have slow, unreliable DSL. So in those areas, you really have to take action, and they have to take action locally because the federal government on broadband has totally turned its back on rural America. It is giving billions of dollars to CenturyLink and AT&T so that by 2020, many more areas will have obsolete DSL. It's a total waste of taxpayer dollars. It's very frustrating. But there's no one building high-capacity networks in rural America for many of these communities. You know, there are some places where you'll have local providers like wireless ISPs or others that are trying to do it. But most communities don't have it. I do want to congratulate those that are building some of these areas out. But it's important to say that without local action, most communities are just going to be stuck with whatever they have or don't have. So that's why we're seeing such an effort. And it is more expensive to do this in Colorado rural than it is in Minnesota rural. So, you know, you have those mountains that are beautiful. They make it more expensive. They make it more challenging. So it's really great to see Colorado, the state government, taking such a stronger role with recent legislation that was passed.
Even for communities now that have opted in to have some type of municipal controlled broadband, there's still the possibility of having private corporations involved in this. There's a lot of discussion, not just in broadband provision, but in all kinds of public areas, from building roads to whatever, you know, including broadband, of public-private partnerships. What should people be paying attention to when this is being put into the conversation?
Well, I think one of the key things to figure out with public-private partnerships is who's taking the risk. And then the secondary question will be who's getting the benefit. But we've seen a lot of public-private partnerships proposed in which the cities take on a lot of the risk. If there's a shortfall with the revenue, the cities have to make it up. But they don't have very much control over the network. That I would consider to be not even a partnership. It might be called a public-private partnership, but it's like the old question about if you call a tail a leg, how many legs does a dog have? There's still four. You can call it what you want, but it doesn't change it. So cities have to be really careful who they're dealing with. They should work with if they're really focused on a partnership approach. They should find a local ISP, maybe a co-op or a small private company that is working nearby that they trust and they know that they can work with. We have not seen any real successful public-private partnerships with the big cable and telephone companies. They have their own plans. They're not nimble enough to work with local governments. So, you know, you could very well have a potential for public-private partnerships in one part of the state and not have that potential in another part if there's no willing partners around.
There's so much discussion now about the FCC and net neutrality and the possible future of that. Is there a connection with municipal-owned, municipal-controlled broadband?
Yes, there is absolutely a connection. One of the things that we see is that both small networks and municipal networks, and all municipal networks are small networks by the scale of the industry, but small providers in general have no incentive to repeal net neutrality. There's definitely been some frustration among small providers in how the rules are implemented. But broadly, the small providers I talk to, they don't want to try and prioritize and create fast lanes. They know that that's going to be more hassle than it's worth. It's only the big companies that have millions of customers where it makes sense to try to create these fast lanes, because they can make a lot of money off it. They can afford the equipment that's required to do that. And they generally know that their customers have no other choice. Most small companies, they're operating in an area where there are other choices. So they can't just abuse their customers in the same way. So in general, we think that relying on local networks is smart, because we cannot count on the federal government to protect net neutrality or our privacy, which was another issue that's wrapped up in some of the net neutrality discussions, but is a bit separate.
In terms of the cable industry's response to this, given that the large corporations, the cable companies, were the ones who were behind a lot of these laws that were written around the country to prevent municipal broadband rollout, how are they responding to this tidal wave we're seeing of more and more and more communities taking back ownership of broadband and electing to have some type of municipal control over their broadband?
Well, Comcast spent a lot of money in 2011 and also in 2009 to stop Longmont from passing their vote. And then after they saw that so many communities were going to pass their votes, they really stopped putting money into opposing it until Fort Collins came along last year. And then between Comcast and CenturyLink, they seem to have put in nearly $900,000, which was an incredible amount relative to what had ever been spent on referenda before in Fort Collins. So I think that's a sign that the cable companies and the big telephone companies are going to start fighting harder. They're going to lobby harder, although I think smart legislatures like Colorado are more savvy to the tricks and the lies that they've been told in the past. But if you look at Wyoming, CenturyLink just totally rewrote the bill there to favor itself in terms of how the state is subsidizing broadband. So I think we're going to see a difference in different states, but Colorado should be pretty happy that its state government was not held captive by those interests.
Well, you are going to be speaking at this event next week in Boulder, Boulder Broadband and Beers, and I know there's going to be a whole host of folks from city leaders to advocates like yourself. What are some of the main talking points? And as I said, what are some of the areas and the issues that people should be paying attention to as this goes forward?
Well, I think one of the funny things that I often have to do in an event like this is temper expectations. I'm thrilled at the amount of interest there is in Colorado, and I'm thrilled at the success Longmont has had. But anyone who studied this recognizes that for a city to get involved in this requires study, it requires a lot of work, and we need people not just to be enthusiastic about having another option, but also ready to really study what the options are. You know, what is a model that's coming out of Idaho, for instance, in terms of how they're financing infrastructure commonly there versus what we're seeing in some other states in where like a city utility like Longmont built it. There's just a lot of different models, and you have to get a sense of them, the weaknesses of each of them. There's a lot of education that has to happen, because even though people will come out and vote against a monopoly like Comcast or CenturyLink, when they actually have a chance to choose another provider, it means they have to call up Comcast and say, I want to switch away from you. And at that point, Comcast will say, well, how about if we cut your bill in half? Will you stay with us? So you don't just need to build a network. You then need to convince people to use it when Comcast and CenturyLink can dramatically lower their prices. That requires a lot of education and enthusiasm, more public events, talking to your neighbors and things like that. So those are some of the things that we'll be covering, the real hard work, in addition to all the excitement about having a real choice in this essential utility.
And of course, I think a lot of people here in Boulder are looking to Longmont because it's in the same county to see how might we move forward. But Longmont really was a different model. Now, I live in Longmont, so I'm one of the beneficiaries of...
I'm jealous.
It's fantastic. And we got the early adopter rate. We signed on right away and we're locked in for life at our house. This like incredible deal. We all take that for granted. But Longmont already had a lot of infrastructure in place. And in many ways, that was why voters were able to really get on board the second time, because despite being outspent by the cable companies, they were able to, you know, really make the case. We have a lot of this infrastructure. It's not a build out from zero. It's a build out from an existing infrastructure. I mean, that's different for a lot of other cities. I'm not sure about Fort Collins and their infrastructure, but I do think that Longmont was already further ahead in terms of the infrastructure build out and what they already had.
That's correct. Longmont had a lot of infrastructure. Fort Collins has some, Boulder has some, but some of the smaller cities, they won't have that. And so they will have to have a more challenging financing plan, perhaps. Or they may have to accept a more incremental approach, where rather than taking 2 years to build the entire community, like a smaller community, you might take 4 or 5 to make sure that you can do it in a reasonable way without taking on too much risk. So those are sorts of things that will have to be considered. But I've seen places that had no infrastructure and had a lot of challenges build up a network that was incredible. So it can be done. And one of the biggest questions is, will there be local leadership, not just on city council or the county board, but from non-elected folks, local business leaders, you know, activists, to really put some sweat equity into making this happen? That's what's going to make a big difference.
And of course, this isn't an abstract thing, because every single person in this community is impacted. And if we look at how education is going, more and more things available online. If we look at how commerce is going, really even the smallest of business has to have some type of e-commerce presence as well. And so much information now only being disseminated digitally. So this really impacts everybody. It's not just about being able to watch movies on Netflix. It's about being part of the modern world.
Yes, it is essential. And one of the most obvious ways that that's clear is children almost always have to do homework online. It's assumed that a child in school is going to be have access to the internet to be able to do their work. And one of the things that we're seeing is, you know, it's not just a matter of speeds. You know, if you live in a place like Boulder, you can probably get high-speed access. But it's increasingly a question of reliability. You know, there's certainly areas where CenturyLink's infrastructure is better than other areas. And there's places where businesses are regularly having outages or problems. They're paying a lot, but they don't have another choice, really, to have a reliable network. And I think that reliability is increasingly going to be an issue, too, as more networks can offer higher speeds. This is also a challenge when people think that, oh, wireless will solve everything. We still don't see anywhere near the level of reliability on wireless connections that we do on wired connections. So there's still a lot of high cost investment that has to happen, even as we have more wireless devices available to us. But it is absolutely essential. Businesses need it. And I think, you know, it's hard to imagine how one would be taking part in this outrageous and fascinating political time without being able to get updates online and see, you know, news online, because you have to find so many different sources to be able to have a sense of what's happening today. So it impacts all areas of our lives.
And in terms of the digital divide, and I know that's a term that we often throw about, but don't always take the time to unpack. I mean, there are so many people who don't have access to this. And we have talked about the fact that many rural communities just do not have access to high-speed internet. But even in urban areas, there's an assumption that everybody has it. But as you said earlier, there's not always equal service or equal coverage available. And we see that particularly where, you know, maybe communities living in poverty in an urban area, communities of colour, different communities don't have access in the same way that others do.
That's right. And that's the single hardest problem to solve in the United States in telecommunications. Solving the rural problem is not nearly as hard as solving the low-income problem. And to some extent, obviously, rural has a low-income component to it. But these networks cost money to build. Someone has to pay for them. That's why historically we did grant those monopolies to a company to make sure they would have enough customers to cover the cost of building out the network. But now that we have competition, we don't have that guaranteed base of income. What that means is, to some extent, some cities may look more at subsidizing a network in parts of town. So Longmont has not put any taxpayer dollars into their network. They financed it with revenue from private investors that bought their bonds. And if you're trying to solve a problem in Denver, for instance, where you may have a higher incidence of poverty than Longmont or Boulder, you may need to say, there's some areas of town in which we're going to subsidize the infrastructure to make sure it's available to everyone. And ideally, that would be a one-time subsidy, not an ongoing subsidy. And in some ways, we can do creative solutions that might involve philanthropy. But it is a very hard challenge to make sure that low-income folks have high-quality access. One of the final things I would say on that is that, to the credit of Comcast and CenturyLink, they do have some programs that have flaws, but nonetheless do deal with making sure people can get a $10 a month access if they have a child in the school lunch program and things like that. So I don't want to come off as saying that, you know, the incumbents are terrible. In some ways, they've been helping this problem, but we need a lot more creative thinking about how to really solve it for the folks that have the least income.
Just as we finish up, Chris, given the importance of access to broadband and high-speed internet, and we've laid out, the reality now, I can only imagine what's going to happen in 5 or 10 years when more things are only going to be available online. Is this being discussed now as a human rights issue, that access to broadband is human rights? I don't want to overstate it, but is it right up there with access to public education, access to water, access to other things?
It is being discussed in that way. So the United Nations has discussed the right to communication, which would now include the internet, presumably, not just be able to speak to your neighbors. There are countries in Europe in which they say that this is a right, and the state may provide some way of ensuring everyone has access. In the United States, I'm not exactly sure what that would mean, given our culture. So I tend to talk of it more on practical terms. And one of the things that I'll say is that we think of electricity as being essential, not necessarily every day or for everyone. I bet there's people living off-grid in Colorado. I know that I've gone camping in Colorado without electricity. But the point is that for a community to thrive, you need that basic infrastructure. Clearly, high-quality internet access is a part of basic infrastructure. If you want to have commerce, if you want to make sure that children have equal opportunity or roughly equal opportunity to get an education and to change their status growing up if they're in low income, you really need high-quality internet access. And I say high-quality because it's not just high-speed, again. It's reliable, and it's able to do the kinds of things that we'll be doing in 5 or 10 years, which I think will be a bit different than what we're doing now.
Well, Christopher Mitchell is the director of the Community Broadband Networks Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Thank you very much for being with us on KGNU.
Thank you for hosting me.